Alexander Jones Live today, Thursday the 25th of April. On this edition, Students Association President Freddie Ford looks back at his year in power. We ask, has he kept his promises? After 5.30, we ask what role historical monuments can play in war zones. And finally, the St Andrews pensioner, who has lost a five-year battle with the courts over expanding town boundaries, will be here at 5.45. That's all here on Alexander Jones Live. And don't forget, you can follow me on Twitter as well. I'm at Mr Jones News. On the 13th and 14th of March 2012, St Andrews went to the polls with record turnout. We elected Freddie Ford as president of the Students' Association, but now his year draws to a close and it's time to look back at what he has done. On the day when the polls opened, he told the Saint, and I quote, "I've talked the talk, but can I walk the walk?" Freddie, can you walk the walk?
I love being interviewed by Alex because I never know what's coming and it's always good. I'm still here, I'm still standing, and I've even started training for a marathon, so I've got progress from walking to running.
But have you actually achieved anything in your year in power then, if we remove the metaphor?
Okay, so I'm not allowed to dance around it like an experienced politician then. You've actually caught me at the time that I'm writing my my report for the AGM this evening, so something's been very much on my mind. I have been very keen this year to focus on tangible results and not on big headlines. And I'm very glad that at the end of the year, my main achievements are not to sit here and tell you about grandiose statements that I've made, which actually don't have anything behind them. I guess the biggest achievement this year, and the one that's been the most well publicised, is securing the funding for the redevelopment. And I've been very clear for a long time that that this has been driven by my approach to the job rather than specific policies that I set out at the beginning of the year. I didn't want to make claims, again, coming back to what I just said about grandiose statements, I didn't want to make claims about things that I didn't have the executive power to execute. So when I said at the beginning, in my manifesto, that I wanted to build constructive relationships, coming in and seeing that the university court had very little trust in the association in many ways because of certain instances last year, I spent a lot of time. It's very difficult to actually get across just how much of the summer and first semester was of my time was spent building bilateral relationships with a lot of the individuals at court, especially the senior court members, getting them to understand that I was someone they could trust. When it came to the actual, should we pass the funding for the redevelopment or not, it didn't even raise discussion, despite quite a lot of concern that when I came into the beginning of the job, that actually it was really up for question whether we would get the funding at all. But as I said, by the time that decision came around in January, it didn't even go through for discussion. I'd managed to rebuild that trust. And there's lots of other achievements. The two other areas I'll mention very briefly that I'm, or the three other areas I'll mention very briefly that I'm very proud of personally are, first of all, the work we've done with accommodation, and particularly working with the SRC member for accommodation, Dougal Adamson, and his team, Cassie and Mimi, who produced a really helpful and, again, tangible report of over 1,000 people responding, what do you want accommodation, what do you want the halls of the future to look like? We've got the commitment from the university for extra halls, but now we actually have a bit more evidence to back up their discussion with private developers, which is something I'm encouraging them to do. And we've also increased the funding, the bursaries to 149,000, I think, 163,000 it is now. The other two areas, very briefly, because I mentioned, I know I'm going on, widening access and the work that we've done to increase funding from the university to do outreach programs that are student-led beyond Fife for the first time, and the work that I've done in promoting the message of St Andrews in the media. And the final one is some restructuring of how the union works internally, and particularly how we communicate what we do and our message. And we're currently undergoing a rebranding process that I initiated back in November, and we'll see the results in a couple of months.
See, I'm interested that you portray yourself as a man of action. We'll come back to your main campaign points in a few minutes. But actually, when you speak to people, union insiders, they suggest that actually you're very good at talking, but when it comes to getting things done, you're not as effective.
Are you referring to anything in particular? I mean, I've just tried to outline some of the specific instances where we have actually got things achieved. I think it's very important to understand that my job is largely one of communication and of strategy, and it's very difficult for me to be able to focus only on one area. I can't say to you that I'm only going to focus on widening access, I'm only going to focus on accommodation. I am ultimately responsible for everything that happens within the building. And there's lots of things that you don't see, which, you know, being good at talking can be helpful for. And that's simple things like relationships in the building between the staff and between the sabbatical officers, and, you know, relationships over the road down at the principal's office as well. That kind of thing is where talking is very useful. And if people can trust you, respect you and like you, and I'm not talking just about myself here, I'm talking about the team as a whole. If we can have that kind of, that cohesion, getting on very well, then that's an important step. I mean, we had a big, you know, first thing we did when we came in is we threw a summer party for all the staff, because when I went down and said hello to one of the porters, she said it was the first time that any sabbatical officer had come and said hello, ever, in her 10-odd years working here. So that side of things is actually very important too, creating that social atmosphere that people are comfortable to working with you in.
Okay, well, we'll take a look now at your main campaign points, and you listed three of them in your campaign. Sure. Constructive relationships, transparency and collective leadership. So we'll look at them each individually, but we'll begin with constructive relationships, which you've already brought up. And how well would you say you get on with Louise Richardson?
I had a conversation with her just last week about something that we had differing views on, and we smiled, we shook hands, and she came along to the Scott Lang dinner on Tuesday. If I need a meeting with her on any particular issue, she'll give me the time. And I think that's quite a good relationship.
And is that an improvement on the situation last year?
Again, it's difficult to overemphasize just how far along that relationship has come. I understand that about halfway through last year, about January, February, the relationship between the principal and my predecessor and his team effectively ended. I understand that she would refuse to be in meetings with the sabbatical officers on certain occasions. I understand that most of the communication was done publicly, so through the media, whereas I have tried to make sure that, again, trust can be maintained. And when we have discussed sensitive issues, we've met and discussed them in person where it's appropriate, to make sure that that the issues don't become personal, and that the issues remain, you know, we can have a professional disagreement, but we won't let it get between our personal relationship.
Do you think it's fair to describe your regime as simply a reaction to that of Patrick O'Hare before you, in that the things that he was strong at are your weaknesses, and vice versa as well?
Well, it depends on your definition of strength and weakness, but I think I can understand why you'd have that view. But I still feel very strongly that my approach to, if we're going to talk about constructive relationships, my approach has actually led to more tangible success. Because at the end of the day, I don't have executive power within the university. There's no lever I can pull. I sit on the Academic Senate and I sit on University Court, but only as one of either one or two of 30-odd people sitting around the table. So if you look at some of the priorities that other sabbaticals have focused on in previous years, widening access, for example, and accommodation, I can sit here and talk to you about tangible differences, tangible results, like funding for Beyond Fife, which is 15 school visits over 3 years.
Which isn't like, actually a significant amount of funding. We were discussing that on the programme last week or the week before.
So if it isn't... Okay, well, if it isn't a significant amount of funding, it's certainly a significant change in attitude from the university, because it's not something they've ever done before, and it's something that the student ambassador has been working on for years, but there hasn't been enough of a call for it. And at the end of the day, when I sat down and through repeated meetings with the vice principal for external relations, I demonstrated to him that I was willing to understand the problem at hand, rather than make grandiose statements outside his office. I was prepared to sit in there and analyse the problem with him inside the office, and the result was that he was more than happy to make that concession. And it's given me a topic to discuss with court members and senior management, and now that programme and programmes like it are more firmly on the agenda, because they are adopted and owned by the principal's office as much as they are adopted and owned by us. And you know, as I said, we can talk about making statements, but you know, tangible achievements have been made. The increase in accommodation bursaries is another one. The actual passing of the redevelopment funding, that there was genuine concern, real genuine concern from within this building, as to whether that would even happen. I think whilst my approach has been different, I don't think that's necessarily fair to say that I haven't had less achieved. It's difficult to measure these things, of course, but I'm, as I said, I'm very proud of the tangible achievements.
And how's your relationship with the town? You've sort of been talking a bit about your relationship with Gown and with the university. Sure. How does it go the other way?
I've got the first student membership of the St Andrew's Preservation Trust up, which is great. I was the only member for about 5 years, and there's about five or six student members now, and I've invited them along on Saturday. We have a history conference about the university, which we're running with your 600th. And three of them are coming along to present to the town there, to the students there, in the hope of attracting more members. So that's nice and interesting, but what does it actually mean? I've separately had a meeting with them and their planning convener about the upcoming HMO cap renewal in June, where at the moment no more HMOs technically allowed to be granted in St Andrews, which has knock-on effects for the cost of housing for students. And we've met up with them in the Old Union Coffee Shop. We've talked about developing a partnership of understanding rather than one of confrontation and conflict.
What does a partnership of understanding actually mean?
It means rather than having a confrontational relationship in the public, in the media, saying, you know, we the Student Association are at loggerheads publicly with the Preservation Trust, or we're also talking to an association called CESARA, which is I forget the acronym, but it's Residents Association for the Central Town. And it's something that if we make progress with the Preservation Trust as a first port of call, we're going to take to the Community Council as well. It means actually talking about the problems, sitting around and discussing them and coming to an agreement, not going on the attack in the papers and annoying people.
But ultimately, you still are likely to disagree.
Yeah, we're likely to disagree, but I'd much rather come to some sort of arrangement where we can agree to put our differences to one side and come to some sort of middle ground. I don't think that, you know, even if you can't get the outcome that you were hoping for from the beginning, I don't think that setting yourself out in a confrontational manner publicly is a very good way of gaining the trust and respect of the people you live with.
Your second pillar was transparency. Mm-hmm. And in a poll conducted by The Saint, which I'm sure we've talked about before on this programme as well, 71% of students were unable to recognise the sabbatical officers from their photos. Do you think if students don't know who you are, that helps with transparency?
I think if The Saint don't know how to conduct a poll which actually has reliable methodology, then I have a question over their journalistic integrity. They produced that poll in October, early October, when students had been back for, 2 weeks? Of course they don't know who we are. Why would they know who we are? I wouldn't know who we are if I was in their position.
Do you think you would do a lot better in it now?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think it would... The problem I had with that poll was that not only was there no comparative data to suggest how better or worse we were known than previous sabbatical officers, it made the assumption that that figure was a bad figure, without any way of backing that up. But it would have been much more useful if they conducted one in their last issue, to see how it had changed over the year. I also wouldn't expect all students to know who we are by our face anyway. And as I said, it was right at the beginning of the year, so in my view, it was pretty useless.
Do you get the impression that now, as the year's gone on, that you've spoken to a lot more students and that you would do a lot better if the same survey was conducted today?
Sure. And, you know, it's been a combination of meeting students face-to-face. I've been to an enormous amount of student events, and wine and cheese at every hall at least once. Opened some student events, closed some student events. But, you know, if you want to get down to the numbers, you just have to look at our online presence. The likes on our Facebook page have nearly doubled to it's about 3,800 at the moment. It was only about half that when we started. I started a blog which never existed before. I've had 4,700 unique visitors and 12,000 page views in total. And my Twitter followers have been up 50%. Now, I know that that's all very impersonal, but I'm trying to give you facts and figures which legitimately demonstrate that we've engaged in a way that we just haven't seen the Student Association do so before.
And do you think students are engaging with the information that you're putting out, that maybe they're looking at it, but is it something that they really care about?
I think I wouldn't be getting so many repeat visits on the website if that was the case. And I don't think I'd be getting... Well, I think we'll come on to this when you come on to my third point, collective leadership. But everything that I've done this year, I've tried as far as possible to have it driven by concerns that students bring to me. I almost feel like one of the successes of this year is to have the union avoiding any kind of controversy, which seems to dog it year on year. I like to think that the team this year brought a mature and respectable approach to how the union conducts itself. And the union is no longer a kind of, oh God, it's that place that kind of annoys people on occasion, to actually, you know what, it's not so bad, it gets on with what it does. And again, it comes back to what I said at the beginning, this can sometimes be an unnecessary, release unproductive clamour for, I want some big statement, or I want some big name or face. And, you know, that might serve my ego personally, but that's not why I'm here in the job. I'm here in the job to deliver services better for students. And there's an enormous amount of things that you or I wouldn't see in the course of our four-year degree, but are really important to, for example, students who are struggling to afford to live here. We set up an accommodation bursary. I mean, not to mention the bursaries increase I referred to briefly earlier. That may not have affected you or some students during their four-year course, but it means a hell of a lot to some students.
What sort of numbers are we talking about that you can help through the bursary funds?
The bursary fund has gone up this year from 120,000 to 163,000.
And how many students can that support?
So that decision is down to me, and I was asked over the summer, how do you want to distribute these funds? And I understand it was rather arbitrarily divided in previous years. So we sat down with the money advisor, student services, and tried to actually identify what the need was, rather than just kind of plucking numbers out of the air. And we decided to split it across postgraduates and undergraduates evenly. And we had 100 undergraduate awards and 20 postgraduate awards.
So do you view that as being quite a substantial amount to help that number of people?
It's 120 students who can demonstrate that they need that money to be able to live here in St Andrews.
Okay. Your third point was about collective leadership. Do you think that this has succeeded?
Yeah. I made bold statements in my manifesto and been elected, you know, on my political view is this and I'm going to achieve that for that aim, then I'm immediately alienating the people who don't necessarily agree with that. So I've done everything I can this year to make sure that the things I have worked on have been driven directly by what people have come to me with and what their concerns have been. Accommodation, of course, is the obvious one. And again, I refer you to the survey. Rather than making that survey came out of a question I was asked in a residential strategy working group about, I think this particular question was, do students want to be grouped together based on what they can pay? You know, do you have financially assessed areas of living? So, for example, at the moment, students in Albany Park are financially assessed in order to be able to live in subsidised accommodation. And the feeling around the room was, yeah, the students do prefer that because they'd rather live somewhere that reflects the quality and cost of what they're paying. But I didn't think that was necessarily the case. But instead of making an arbitrary decision there and then, I said, well, let's ask them. And that grew and grew and grew. And then we ended up with this huge survey, which is far better information than the university have ever had. And it said overwhelmingly that actually no, students don't want that. So there's a direct example of how the strategy of the university has been changed by listening to what people have to say rather than imagining that I know the answer to everything.
Again, I remember last year when I was here with Patrick O'Hare, and I was able to find a lot more precise points in his manifesto where we were able to look and say, okay, achievement, okay, this hasn't been achieved. Do you think that you've actually just been too vague overall, and do you maybe wish that you'd done some more specific things, put more specific things in your manifesto?
It comes down entirely to how you perceive the position, and I've maintained clarity on this from the time that I put my campaign together. My approach to this job has been based around what competencies I think I can bring to the challenges that I face day on day, you know, day on day, week on week. I did not want to put specifics in my manifesto because it would alienate people who didn't necessarily agree with those as priorities, and it wasn't necessarily my decision to make those decisions. In fact, there's very little I can do without having the agreement of other people. So I think fundamentally my approach to the job has been to remove as far as possible the dogmatic politics and to increase what I see as being student-led policies, i.e. what comes up throughout the year. I mean, we didn't know that champagning would come along, for example. We didn't know that I can't think of an example off the top of my head, but the NUS referendum, for example. Had I, for example, to take, you know, would I prefer to have policy statements? Had I, and this is consistent with my approach, had I said that I was going to either be in or against the NUS vote, then I would immediately have alienated and annoyed people who did not agree with that statement. So consistent with my policy that I will bring a certain approach to the job at hand, I said I'm not going to take a side in this. I'm going to let the students have their voice. And it's entirely consistent.
What would your biggest disappointment of the year be then?
I think that I could have spent more time at student events and societies. I found it difficult to manage my time sometimes. I have worked very, very hard and sometimes too hard, and then not been able to enjoy some of the student activities in the evenings. I'm enormously lucky that I've got such a capable societies team, particularly Meg, the Dosda. And I just wish that I'd been able to see more of those student events at hand, because, you know, I've spent most of the year arguing for their need at the redevelopment funding argument. If I could have seen more of that, that would have been great.
What are your plans for now when you leave office?
I have a job in San Francisco, which I'm due to take up in October, although I've just recently discovered that they have exceeded the number of visa applications, so I'm in a lottery. So I've got a 62.5% chance of moving to the US, and if not, then I'll probably end up in London.
And how much work are you doing with Chloe Hill to ensure a smooth handover to next year? How much?
We've had quite a few meetings already. She'll be coming along to all of the major committee meetings that I have with the university and within the association, the last of each of those meetings. We spend 2-3 weeks in June. Basically, she'll be shadowing me. What's important for me is to make sure that she has the context surrounding her own ideas, and that she knows who the key people to work with are, what the past issues are that she may not have been aware of, that sort of thing.
Do you think that she will be sort of following along your footsteps, similar model, or do you think she will take a completely different approach to the job?
I think it's very rare that you have students who are who have this the sort of strength of idea to run on their own steam for a position like the president without having their own way of doing things. And I know that she's enormously experienced, so I think she'll be a great asset.
What would your piece of advice to her be, if you could give her just one piece of advice?
I'd say the most important part of this job that I've learned is just knowing when to take a breath and take a step back and just say, whoa, you know, things can seem very hot very quickly. And I think it's important just to understand that there's a much wider context to that that you thought you understood originally. Because I've seen more than anything else just how broad the student interests are here, and if you act too quickly, then you might end up alienating more people than end up agreeing with you.
In the same article that I quoted at the very start of this interview from The Saint on the day of the elections last year, you were asked to sum yourself up in one word and you said passionate. What would you say if you were asked the same question today
about my
to sum yourself up
just
in
me
one
as a
word
person.
Yes,
I think I'd probably use the same word.
Do you think that there's been a lot of passion in the last year, or has that been something that has been missing from your regime?
I think that's specifically something that I've brought to the role. I've been very keen to work hard. As I said, I'm probably working too hard at sometimes, and to communicate what we're doing. You only need to speak to the staff in the building that I work with every day, and I'm sure that passion without prompting them would be the word they come up with, because I have felt very much responsible for every single thing that the association does, and I haven't tried to let anything slip through the gaps. And wherever there has been a service that hasn't been delivered properly, even if it's not directly within my purview, I feel personally responsible. And there have been several occasions where I've brought different parts of the staff in the building together to make sure that we understand what's gone wrong and why it's gone wrong.
And finally, there's the 600th anniversary this year, mm-hmm. towards the end of your time. What are you hoping will be happening over that? What sort of things are we expecting?
I think the university principal just sent an email about this afternoon regarding celebrations, so you'll probably see the whole calendar there. I really hope that... I tell you what I'm really looking forward to is the Your 600th campaign, which I've been running all year. There are 6 students on that committee who, between them, will have raised approaching £15,000 this year, which is going to endow a bursary, a scholarship, for a student who otherwise wouldn't be able to come and study here. I think that's an enormously powerful 600 statement, and that's something that will go on forever and ever and ever. There will always be a student here who relies on the work of other students fundraising for their scholarship, and that's something I'm enormously proud of, this student's putting together in the 600th anniversary.
Freddie Ford, thank you very much, and all the best.
Thank you, Alex.
Thank you. And still to come on the programme today, we will be talking to the St Andrews pensioner who has lost her legal battle against the expansion of the town. She has spent £179,000 on legal expenses and will be here at 5:45 to explain why. And in just a few moments after the news, we'll be discussing the news that in Aleppo, a minaret has been destroyed from the 11th century. What protection should be provided to World Heritage sites? So we'll be discussing that in just a few moments here on Star. In just a second, we will have the latest from Star News, and they're just getting ready in the studio now. Remember, you can contact me on Twitter. I'm at Mr. Jones News, and you can tweet me and let me know your views on any of our stories throughout the programme. And we will be back again next week with our final edition for the semester. But for now, it's 5:31 and time for the latest from Star News.
Academic celebration ticket ballot opens.
40 found alive in Bangladeshi factory ruins.
With a 5:30 Star News, I'm Michael Kotchel.
And I'm Susanna Sabin. The academic celebration ticket ballot has opened today. The event, happening in September, is part of our university's 600th year anniversary celebrations. One of the key moments taking place during the event will be a graduation ceremony for honorary graduates, renowned academics such as Dame Jane Goodall, Professor Judith Butler, and Professor Dame Marilyn Strathern are amongst the confirmed honorands.
40 people have been found alive in the rubble of a collapsed Bangladeshi factory. The building collapsed on Wednesday morning. It is estimated that 2,000 people were in the Rana Plaza building when it collapsed. 220 people are confirmed dead. Police are searching for the owner of the building, who is thought to have added 3 extra floors illegally and told the factory workers to enter the building despite visible cracks in the walls. The search for survivors continues.
The British economy has avoided triple-dip depression after recording faster-than-expected growth in the first 3 months of this year. The Office for National Statistics said its first estimate for GDP showed an economic growth of 0.3% in the first quarter of 2013. George Osborne commented that the figures demonstrate that the economy is healing. In contrast, the IMF has stated that the UK should reduce its austerity program if it wants to achieve faster growth.
8 complete sets of skeletal remains were found beneath an Edinburgh car park. Construction was being done for the new Edinburgh Centre for Carbon Innovation and to set up a rain harvesting tank as part of Edinburgh University's low carbon scheme. Scholars already knew that there was a 13th century monastery in that area, and the remains of what is believed to be a medieval knight were found earlier this year. However, this excavation revealed the monastery's exact location. Ross Murray, the archaeologist who found the skeletons, called the site a treasure trove of archaeology. The archaeological staff is being provided by Edinburgh's Headland Archaeology.
Footage of last night's Queen Street party was captured by one of our Star News correspondents. For more details, check the Star page on Facebook.
And in today's weather forecast, some sunny spells are developing in the afternoon and evening, with the possibility of some scattered showers. Tonight will be dry, with high temperatures of 11 degrees.
And those are today's headlines. For more news, tune in tomorrow and check the Star News pages on our website.
To Star, University of St Andrews radio station.
St Andrews' only radio station.
This is Star.
Contact us here at the studio by buzzing the studio from www.standrewsradio.com.
You're listening to Alexander Jones live here on St Andrews Radio. Yesterday, the ancient Aleppo minaret in Syria was destroyed. It dated from the 11th century and was a World Heritage Site, described by UNESCO as one of the most beautiful mosques in the Muslim world. But due to the ongoing Syrian civil war, it is no more. So what role should historical monuments play in conflict? I'm joined by Jimmy Bolton. He is the deputy editor for the St Andrews History Society Journal with specific responsibility for the medieval period. Welcome to the programme, Jimmy.
Hi.
So what do you think is so important about these World Heritage Sites that they should be protected in war?
Well, historical monuments are, they're really important, particularly when it comes to ideas of national identity, of national pride. These places aren't just, they're not just buildings, they're not just, well, building. They're things that people look up to and they feel real attachments to ideas of the past. And, I mean, this particular mosque, thankfully the mosque itself wasn't entirely demolished. It was badly damaged, but it was the minaret that was collapsed. And, I mean, that site, just as an example, is a mosque that was built in 1090. It was built on top of a Christian church that had been there before. That itself was built on top of a Greek agora that had been there before. And so it's this amazing sort of cultural mixing of civilizations actually, to be honest, back then living together in much greater harmony than they are now. And even in that sense, it's a great example, I think, for the current state of affairs.
The historian in all of us, I think, can get very nostalgic when these things happen and quite sad about the situation. But ultimately, what difference does it make to a country today to not have that or to have it?
Well, look at the town we're in right now. We're in St. Andrews. It is a medieval town. A lot of people come to this university in order to be around the architecture and the history around this place. But, I mean, an example I was thinking of when I was asked to be on this show was the cathedral itself. The cathedral was the second greatest pilgrimage site in all of Europe in its time. But in the Reformation, it was stripped of its altars and its images. It was later abandoned during the Reformation. It then collapsed. Much of it collapsed, as you can see, not much of it remains. And nothing was done to preserve it at all until the mid-19th century. In the early modern period, people in this town just didn't really care. It was just a building that had fallen into disrepair. But since then, the people, well, the Victorians and then later Historic Scotland, when that started up, have done a massively amazing job in preserving that place. And the castle, again, is another example of a place. People come to St. Andrews to see these places. And in countries which don't have that kind of history, there often isn't that same connection with the past that is, I think, really an integral part of British life.
Do you think a connection with the past can be described as integral like that, or is it just really economic? Because ultimately, the reason you often hear it argued in Britain that many of our traditions are good because they boost tourism, and is this really, for Syria, just a bad move because they're harming their future economy?
Yeah, I'm not entirely sure that that's really foremost in their minds, but it is true that, you know, there are six UNESCO World Heritage Sites in Syria, and all of them have been damaged. None quite so badly as the Grand Mosque. And they are shooting themselves in the foot, but right now they're shooting themselves quite literally in the face. And I think it's a tragedy currently, I think, for the world that this has happened. But in Syria, it's a fight for survival. I mean, I do not... There is obviously a point at which you stop considering the historical importance of an event and worry about the human cost. There's an argument even to say whether... There's an argument about who actually did this, whether it was rebels or whether it was the government. And there are some people blaming the government for doing this because the rebellion obviously has a strong link to the Islamic religion. A lot of the people supporting the state are actually atheists or secularists, and so attacking the mosque is seen as an attack on the rebels. Even that isn't unusual. During the Second World War, during the destruction of Warsaw, the Nazis actually brought in historical scholars in order to more effectively destroy Warsaw by taking down these symbols, destroying these symbols of sort of Polish nationalism. And it's quite clear that these historical places have great resonance all through history.
So when we're looking at these buildings which have lasted a long time, and we're looking at the monuments, what you mentioned, St. Andrews, do you think there's a huge element of luck in determining which buildings survive, or is there something in the country's history itself which actually explains whether the monuments are still there or whether these buildings have been destroyed through other activities?
Well, yeah, it helps if you haven't been in an area that was too particularly affected by something, for example, the Second World War. If you look at, say, I've already used the example of Warsaw, a lot of Eastern Europe, Dresden is another example, the city that was completely destroyed by German Allied bombing. The areas that were less touched by these by war tend to have these areas survive better.
It's interesting the point that you raised before as well about the claim for that and how there's two narratives, one from the opposition, one from the government, both blaming the other for what's going on. And although clearly someone is responsible, neither of them wants to say that they did this. They clearly do value something in this historical monument as well.
Yeah. You know, it doesn't look good to destroy your national heritage. You know, both these sides are fighting for nationalist causes. They're not trying to disintegrate the idea of Syria. They're merely trying to take down either opposition to the state or take down the leaders of the state. And to attack a site or a building like the minaret is to attack Syria in a very fundamental sense.
And this ongoing civil war in Syria, are we expecting that this sort of thing will continue more, that there will be more national treasures lost? Is that an inevitability of war?
I think it is. These cities in the Holy Land, for want of a better word, are these sites are in the middles of the cities. They are very much planted in the centre of the conflicts. And when there's indiscriminate bombing, indiscriminate shelling, even targeted at where the civilians are, these places are always going to be hit. And when it comes down to war, at the end of the day, people will hide, people will shelter in whatever they can find. If that happens to be a historical building, well, that's then, in the eyes of some, makes it a legitimate target.
How many buildings do we have around the world dating from the 11th century?
I don't have the exact figure in front of me, but a lot.
There is still a lot. This isn't completely losing an era that we're going through at the moment.
No, I mean, as I said, I mean, there are six. This is one World Heritage Site. There are, I want to say, hundreds, maybe well over that in the world. I think there's at least 30 just in this country. We're not talking about some sort of cultural vandalism that will destroy our entire heritage, but I mean, this comes this year. Last year, there was in Mali, in Timbuktu, there were reports of widespread destruction by Islamists of scrolls, of mausoleums, and the worry is that, you know, it's not this one act, but if we don't cause a fuss when this sort of thing happens, and we don't outcry at cultural vandalism, then people won't think it matters.
For us here in the West, though, what is there that we can actually do actively to try and prevent this happening? Do we just have to stand by and watch this being destroyed?
Well, I mean, when I was asked on this show, I did a little bit of research because I didn't want to do my essay. And, I mean, it wasn't until 1863 was the first time that anyone ever bothered to make the idea of cultural vandalism a part of the rules of war. That was during the American Civil War, and then that was adapted into the Hague Convention in 1954. But, I mean, these have all been continuing since then. I would much rather the international community try to come up with a solution to the civil war in Syria than merely concentrated on destruction of historical buildings. But I think at the same time, people need to understand that taking down an historical building is not going to stop a revolution.
Jimmy Bolton, thank you very much for joining me. Thank you. A St Andrews pensioner has lost her legal battle against the expansion of this town. Penny Uprichard has spent £179,000 on legal expenses, but has now lost her case in the Supreme Court. Fife Council can now push ahead with plans for 1,090 new houses, a science park and transport links. Penny, welcome to the programme.
Thank you.
So, what exactly is it about this expansion that you oppose so strongly?
I think St Andrews is a very special town. It's got an 800-year-old history. It's got a sensitive landscape, and it sits in a green bowl, which is its landscape setting. And I think it needs to be considered what the need for expansion is and whether you can extend it. to infinity to accommodate anyone who it thought might want to live here without damaging its character and its charm.
Okay, we'll come back to the character in a minute. First of all, I want to deal with the need, because on this programme we're continually discussing accommodation. We regularly have students on here telling us about their problems finding somewhere to rent. We've had local Labour councillor Brian Thompson on as well, explaining problems for people in the town as well who want to find houses because the students take the market from them. So is there showing that there is actually a clear demand for this housing here?
I don't believe that a council can give priority to people currently living in St Andrews or others who want to come back to St Andrews or their relatives when allocating housing. We haven't had any affordable housing in the town since 2006, and I think there are various reasons for that. One is that land is very expensive here. Another is the HMOs, which you mentioned, student accommodation. Yeah. The town centre is now 85% HMOs. This means that people who want to buy here are likely to be jumped to it by landlords. And it does not promote a healthy town centre. The town is a desert out of term time. There is also the fact that the university has more than doubled its student numbers since 1996. And I think everybody welcomes the students. My brother was a student here. I certainly welcome the students. But it's the numbers. And at what point does the increase stop? And I think the result of all this, we've got the university, Fife Council and the Scottish Executive pouring people into the town. And I think the result is very like a battery hen farm. We are scratcheting and turning on each other. The students want affordable, accessible accommodation. People coming back to retire or just wanting to live in St Andrews also want reasonable accommodation. And it basically doesn't exist anymore.
But is that not inevitable in St Andrews? You've got university, you have the golf course, and you're also in a place where you can have commuting to Dundee as well. There's a lot going on in this small town. So is that not something that can't be avoided, that this is somewhere that people will want to live?
Well, if it's accepted that that can't be avoided and the town is going to expand to infinity, why not? Will it become like Glenrothes? Why is 1,000 houses being planned here instead of in Glenrothes, where they'd be barely noticed? And I think also it's a minimum of 1,000 houses. It's a 10-hectare science park, a 10-hectare business park, a distributor road. But we've only got one town centre, and it's a medieval town centre. It's got three streets pointing towards a cathedral. It is not capable of expansion. We already have gridlock. I think the maintenance in the town is dreadful. Four wheelie bins per household don't exactly add to it, particularly in summer when they smell. The shops have nowhere to put those bins at the back of the premises. I think St Andrews is having huge demands imposed in it, which I don't think it's able to bear. And it is the most important small historic borough in Scotland, according to Historic Scotland. And I think it should be protected.
Do you think that the character of the town will ultimately be affected by this? Because this is expansion on the edges. As you've said yourself, they can't build any more in the centre. So does this really affect what's going on here, where we're sat now in the centre of town?
Yes, it will certainly affect it, and we are building in the centre. We've got the biggest development ever in the middle of St Andrews in Abbey Walk at Knightsbridge. Currently, I think it's proposed to put 260 houses there, but the council has said that this number will not be deducted from the Western Extension. There's also the point that all the traffic for the East Nuke has to come through the town. If the Lingo and Kenley Green wind farms go ahead, all the traffic, including the 1,000 tonnes of concrete to bed each turbine in, will come through St Andrews. And there is other expansion as well. Green spaces are being built on, extensions are being added all over the place. And people need green space. I get the feeling sometimes that for Fife Council, green space, green belt, is just a development opportunity sitting around waiting to be built on. But it's very necessary for people's health and welfare, peace of mind, as is walking on the West Sands.
Is the argument you've not put forward just now about the, in particular, the transport gridlock here, is that not exactly going against what you said before? Because this new infrastructure on the edge, the new roads, would indeed actually help the situation and drive traffic away from the centre of town and round the edges instead.
If we had a new settlement based around Strathkinnis High Road, which is the proposal, do you seriously think that people would come here and just go to some shops, if they were ever established there, and not come into the town? not look at St Salvator's or the castle or the West Sands or the East Sands or anything else. I think it's unlikely.
How much debt has this put you in personally, this legal fight?
I don't know the exact figures yet, but after the appeal hearing, which I lost in July last year, in July 2012, I think it was 12, the judges decided to impose 173,000 costs against me. And a lot of people are having a very hard time at the moment financially. So I chose to do this. I don't have children who grow out of shoes every year. I don't have a mortgage. But it seems to me deeply unfair that somebody wanting to challenge this sort of thing could have these horrific costs imposed. And I also think it is deeply unfair that both Fife Council and Scottish ministers were represented in court and that I have to pay the charges for both of them.
Do you think it's been worth it?
If I'd known at the beginning that 4 years on I would be here in this position now, I would probably have said no. You don't know. It's a ratchet effect. You go as far as you can go, then you're refused, and then something turns up. I think for St Andrews it's worth it. Not many people are in the position of not having family and not having mortgage and able to do this sort of thing. And I do feel that the planning system is virtually totalitarian. I think this demonstrates that we have no opportunity to oppose or complain about decisions made by unelected officials, both in the council and in the Scottish Government. I think that's a very unhealthy position.
How much support do you have for your position in the town's community as a whole?
I haven't counted heads, but when I appealed for funds, I collected £33,000, and that was after the credit crunch. So I think that that is remarkable. I think people were most generous. The fact that the costs are going to so far outstrip that couldn't have been foreseen. But the economic position does almost make me wonder whether the proposal for the Western Extension is viable anyway. It was started in 2002, and the council in 2005 published a structure plan and a local plan running in parallel. That's a very rare event and was very confusing for people. But that was, again, before the credit crunch. Is it really a possibility now that this is going to happen? We've been told in committee that it won't happen for at least 5 years. Does that mean that it may be pushed further ahead? On the other hand, the Tay plan has been approved, the one covering four local authorities. It is in power until 2032, and presumably officials think that by then everything will be back to, quote, normal, quote.
Do you think that this plan will actually matriculate into something else? Because we're seeing, as you say at the moment, it's just plans. There's not planning applications. You've still got the opportunity to oppose them as well, don't you?
I think that's not a realistic suggestion. If it's in the development plan, and if we have a developer-led council, as we do, and if we have the Scottish Government pushing for a lot of development and for wind farms, I don't think it's realistic to suppose that planning applications for part of all this won't go through.
One of the suggestions in this is for a science park. Could you see the advantages of that to the town?
I don't know enough about a science park to question that. You might know far more about it than I do, I'm sure, so I would ask you.
I'm purely suggesting on the basis of the scientific knowledge that is within the university already and the large research centre that's already happening here. Would another science park actually help that?
It would be another large building. It would be a very large building. And I have no idea how that would fit in with molecular sciences and physics and everything else that's on the North Hall. So I can't really answer that question.
How long have you lived here?
My grandparents came here in 1911, lived in Hope Street while building a house in Hepburn Gardens. My mother lived here, my aunt lived here, my brother went to university here. And it's always been my base, well, from the age of seven, as I was born in Northern Ireland. So I feel very embedded in St Andrews. And I feel that that's why I felt it was worth fighting for.
Is there anything in particular that makes St Andrews so special? Is there any quality that you can lay your hands on?
Well, it's a lot of things to a lot of people. It's a lot of things to golfers, to students, and to residents. But it has changed enormously in the last 15 years. And I think that, the ease of living here has vanished, the ease of going around. You can drive around the town now, but it's very difficult to stop. There isn't enough parking. You could say there are too many cars. I mean, obviously, both applies. The bicycle lanes make things difficult. I don't think bicycle lanes within the town make things any easier for anybody.
Maybe they help students cycling around the town.
Well, yes, I don't know how much they do because it's quite difficult to keep within them. I think it's a good town for cycling in any way. I don't think that's a problem. But I think that it is just, it's the battery hen thing again. I think too many people and too many demands are being made on the town.
What size would you say St Andrews is too big at? Is it already beyond that size, in your opinion?
Well, I think if you look at the suburbs stretching out into the countryside, yes, it is, because I don't think we don't have a Scottish vernacular for small houses. It's just an English vernacular, little boxes everywhere. I don't think that they're necessarily that they go along with the medieval houses and the centre of town. I don't think it's possible to say what size it should be. I think the figures in the local plan, which says that there are 16,351 residents, including students, are extremely strange, and there have been a lot of objections about that, but it seems impossible to establish it, partly because, of course, not all the students live in St Andrews now because there isn't room. So I believe you have students living in Dundee and in Strathkinnis and so on, so it is not easy to assess the number actually living within the town boundaries.
What role do you think the university has to play in this? Obviously, the university is integral to the town, and as you say, students are living outside the town. So are you expecting them to be behind any developments?
This is a university proposal, the 1,000 houses in the Science Park. It was proposed by the university in 2002 and was subsequently taken into the structure plan by the Fife Council in 2006, which was a great shock to many residents and resulted in between 4 and 5 times more objections than ever before for a structure plan. I think the university has a responsibility. I believe it's been said that they accommodate more students than some other universities, but the number of students, according to the Higher Education Statistics Agency, is 9,538.
Including postgraduates.
Postgraduates. Yeah. And I believe that's a relevant figure rather than full-time equivalents. 2 full-time equivalents, 2 beds, possibly 2 cars, 2 places to stay. I think that figure, the HESA figure, is a relevant one. So if you deduct that from the population figure, 16,351, of course, you get about 7,000 residents, whereas in 1996 it was 14,000. Now, you can't do that because of the number living outside the town boundary, but it's an indication. I think the numbers of residents have dropped, and the residents are needed as well to make a vibrant town centre and to support the shops out of town time.
What dialogue have campaigners like yourself had with the university?
I personally haven't had any dialogue. I think it's quite difficult to discuss this sort of thing. I think that the university should discuss with the town the numbers of students and should have discussed it before the numbers were greatly increased, because as far as I know, there wasn't, over the last 10 years, any discussion about that. It's our town. It belongs to all of us. We all want it to be viable and friendly and to accommodate everyone who wants to live here. But it's not possible.
Penny Upridge, thank you very much for speaking to me here on Star. Thank you.
And that brings us to the end of today's edition. I'll be back next week with the last edition of the semester. Remember, in the meantime, you can follow me on Twitter. I'm at Mr. Jones News. And I'll be back then again next week. And there's the latest from Star News every day at 5:30. But for now, I'm Alexander Jones. Thank you for listening. Good night.
Tune in to Star, University of St. Andrews radio station.
St. Andrews' only radio station.
This is Star.
Contact us here at the studio by buzzing the studio from www.standrewsradio.com.